Good morning. I will be trying to what I call a dangerous exercise this morning. Trying to walk you through 550 years of history. But particularly this morning, you have to bear with me. We had a great devotion this morning, and thank you to April and George for walking us through that. And I'm in a very emotional state this morning, so bear with me. I'm starting this exercise by reading something from an Haitian journalist, just to let you know, I mean, the state of mind that we are still in the country. And when he says, "We no longer cry for the dead during funerals anymore. There were too many of them in January 12, and not enough tears." We are still weeping and still crying, but very often we don't really find the tears. Haiti normally never really made the headline news. If it was not for a hurricane or a military coup, a coup d'etat, or the Tonton taking powers, or somebody, you know, assassinating somebody in Haiti. And the history of Haiti, it's what I call a song, and we've seen that in the cultural part. But also it's a painful story for us to carry. So we will go really quickly through this 550 years of history, very quickly, looking at the Caribbean indigenous period with the Taino and the Arawak Indian in the country. But we really like to call them, you know, the indigenous people. In the 1492, from 1492 to 1791, through the arrival of Columbus and the flourishing colony of France and Spain, we will go through the revolt and the battle for the independence, and from 1804 to 1915, and go very quickly to all our missed opportunities for the country. And from the 1915 to the 1934, which was the first U.S. occupation in the country, and historian, American writers probably have different narrative of it, but Haitian historians call it the benevolent imperialism. So that means something that was not necessary, but that was done for the U.S. political interest. From the 1957 to 1886, you go to the Duvalier era, probably that most of you have heard or know. And the 91 opportunities, missed opportunities again with Aristide and Hope for Haiti. And the 1991 to 1993, the boat people invasion, invading the coast of Florida, and the 1993-1994, the return of Aristide and the second U.S. invasion, 20,000 U.S. troops flooding the country, and the return of Aristide to power, and what does it mean today with Martelly clay skin, but not mulatto. No political experience, but has a huge backup and support of the masses. And his only option is to succeed. So that's what we are saying in here. Let's go, Scott. Before I get into the pre-Columbus era, I would like to make a start to give you some basic information about Haiti today. We are sharing the island, as you can see on the map, and we'll go back to a larger map after that. We share one third of the island, 27,000 square kilometers. Very tropical. We don't have snow. We don't know about snow. We said to the last census of 2008 that we are at 9 million, but nobody really knows how many are we today. But we know there is more than 2 or 3 million Haitians that are living abroad in New York, in Florida, in Canada, in France, around Paris and so on. So, and a lot of Haitians, you know, scattered throughout of the island. So, the Caribbean island. 80% are Roman Catholics, 60% are Protestant, 4% are others, and 100%, you know, believe in voodoo. Life expectancy, you know, male 59 and 63. And there's an interesting joke on that as well. And the poverty is based on what we call the access of the job market and the real job that has been counted on the Haitian market. So go back, Scott, go back, stay here, stay with me. On your right, you have a couple of dates probably that we need to remember when we talk about Haiti. We have the we have the 1803 May 1803 in Haiti when during the independence battle, a couple of people united. And a group of women met in Acaya, small town north of Port-au-Prince, met and decided to create a flag. And you can see from the French flag that I've seen on one of the streets here, it's the French flag goes horizontally, vertically, I would say. So what they did, they took out the white from the French flag, and they created their own. So, and this flag has been created in 1803 by a group of women, and there's a tale saying that one of them were a little crazy and came out and celebrated that. And the other thing that Haitians are very proud of is the citadel in Cap Haitien that was built after what we call the Second Empire. When Dessalines died, and we'll go to that, and Henri Christophe took power, and the country split into two, the southern part and the northern part. And Christophe, to protect the northern part of the country from the invaders, because that's where Christopher Columbus arrived, and we'll see that, created the citadel there to protect the bay of Cape Haitia. Let's discuss that. So, this is the Hispaniola island that we share with the DR. Again, it is how history is written, you know. Very often history is written by the conquerors, you know. The one who wins writes history. So, and the narrative that they brought forward may not be the real narrative. And our own narrative that was written by Thomas Madieu, one of the Haitian famous writers, and taken by many others after that, says, you know, the birth of Haiti started, you know, during the 1200th century, you know, with the Caribbean Indian and the Arawak, you know, crossing the river and crossing the sea from the other side of the Atlantic, that were fleeing the cannibals on the other side of the Caribbean Ocean, and arrive, you know, in what we call around this area, what we call Lekai, you know, around this area, and they settle there, you know, and they're creating their own civilization and their own political system and so on. So, and during that era, and I will show you a map, we have one of the famous what we call Haitian, and we still celebrate her as really the founder of the real Haitian nation, which was Princess Anna Kaona, that was born in the cacique of Zaragoa, and later married Kaonabo, one of the king of the other cacique, and created the largest political system that we ever known, you know, in the human history. When Christopher Columbus arrived in 1492, there were 500,000, you know, indigenous people living on the island, and with the union of Anna Kaona with Queen Kaonabo, they were creating the largest, you know, political area. So this is how the island was organized before Columbus arrived. So we had 5 regions in Haiti, and at that time that was Haiti. Written in the indigenous language, like as that the name that we took today. So you have the Jaragua Cacica, that's where Anna Kaona was born. The Maguana Cacica, with his own queen and political organization. And they married together, and they create the largest part, and they govern the entire part of the island at that time. So we didn't have Dominican Republic and Haiti. So you had all the Indian indigenous population scattered throughout the island, of the island. And that's what Columbus found when he arrived, when his boat worked there in 1942. So when Columbus arrived somewhere around here, as Mitch explained yesterday, around Port-au-Prince, you know, he set up the first fortress. They call it the first settlement of European descent people on the island. And they created a fortress, and they call it Natividad, on the north coast of the island of Hispaniola. Because Christopher Columbus, as you can remember, arrived in December 5th, 1492. So they call the settlement Navidad because of the Spanish language, you know, that was close to Christmas and the celebration of Christmas. So you have this detailed map of Haiti today with 10 geographical department, call it department by now, with the northern department with the capital city of Cape Haitian, the northwest department with its political organization in Port-au-Prince, and you have the north for Liberté, and you have all the Central Plateau with Ange in the middle, and you go down, you have the Artibonite, and down there you have Port-au-Prince in the western department, and you go to the southeast with Jacmel, Lekai, and Jérôme. So you have 10 geographical departments, and this new department that just been created with the capital city in Miragoan that we call the new in here. So because one of the boats, you know, of Christopher Columbus was destroyed, so he had a real problem because he couldn't continue his travel with all the men that he had on board. So he was forced to leave behind around 39, he suicided 39 men that were supposed to stay at the Natividad Fortress and continue to work with the islanders. So when he arrived, because of the mistreatment of the 39 men, but also, it's not because the indigenous people, as it was written, you know, by many writers, European writers, says that all the 39 men were eaten by the Taino Indian. But the reality is, the Taino Indian and the Arawak Indian, they are not cannibal. They are on this side of the island in the first place because they were fleeing the cannibals. So there is no way they could have been cannibals themselves. So, and these men died because they brought with them, you know, yellow fever. And there was no medication on the island with a tropical system, you know. They got dengue and so on, and they died, you know. And Columbus, when Columbus arrived, so they had to move a little bit north in what is now Cape Haitien, and they settled, you know, the other another settlement, and they call it this time Natividad, you know, that means, you know, newness, you know, in the land. And later they renamed this colony Santo Domingo because of his shape and landscape and so on. So that's the second travel of Christopher Columbus. As I mentioned already, 500 people were living on the island. And at the end of the Spanish colonization, you had only 2,500 survivors of what we call the disaster of the discovery. These 2,000 with Cassicari, took the mountain of the Barroco, which is somewhere in what you are calling now San Felipe, around here. They took the Barroco mountain and fight the Spaniard, but they all, you know, perish during the fight. And the 50 or 50-something plus Indian that were left were taken off by Father Las Casas, Catholic priest that came up with the Spanish invasion, and said we need to protect the indigenous spaces, as they call it, and do something about it. So from this meeting of mine of Father Las Casas and the other people from the Spanish Inquisition, and his little story says that Queen Isabel from Spain would sell, you know, how do you say that, to au plus offrant.
More money.
When you help me here, when you put something, you know, as an offering, people have to bid on it.
Is that auction?
Auction. Yeah. So Queen Elizabeth, you know, has to auction his jupon.
It's an underskirt, actually.
Has to, you know, auction his underskirt to finance, you know, the expedition, you know.
It's not with the real name. It's not the real name. You know, when you have, you can see through your clothes, and then there's another thing you put under.
Skirt.
That's
what I remember. So that's the reason why Christopher Columbus, when he arrived on the island, you know, his mandate was to baptize in the name of the Pope, you know, and ransom in the name of the Queen, you know, and all his possession and all the thing and what he does, you know, on the island was protected by the decree of Queen Elizabeth. So, to restore history also in this right, the colonization really, and even the arrival of the slave on the island of Hispaniola, didn't start with the French, you know, because some people said, you know, the slavery on the island started with the French, but it's not true. Slavery started under the Spanish Inquisition and the Spanish occupation because they were supposed to.
I just had a question about the 500,000 indigenous people who were there and then they were suddenly gone. Was it because of disease that they also died? Or was it being killed by the Spaniards?
It was both. But the majority died because of dengue fevers, you know, and all the diseases that these people brought with them. Because you have to remember, all those that came on the boat with Columbus, and the same thing will happen also under the French occupation. They were all people that had something to see with justice, you know, the people that were creating problems to the political system of that time, you know? And there was a good way of getting rid of all these people, you know? Go away! So these people, you know, I mean, and history, even Montesino, write a lot of things. Columbus, and even Diego Colón later, had to fight because he needed people with skill to come with him on the expedition. And he was giving a lot of paria and people that he couldn't use, that he had to take them. So that's one of the things that happened. But by the middle of the 17th century, for us to go really very quickly and skipping to the French started to arrive, you know, while the Spanish were still on the island of Hispaniola. They start to arrive in the area and they settled themselves in one here. They settled themselves here, you know, on the island of Tortuga, what we call Île de la Tortue in Haiti. And they settled there, but it was an interesting spot because that's where, in the middle of the 1600s, you know, the Spanish start to be, because of all the problems that they have and the disease on the island, and at that time, Colón, you know, went around, you know, continued his travel and exploration and so on, and end up in Mexico, you know, and they discovered all the gold and the mine and all these things that is happening, you know, in Mexico City. So they had less interest on this part of the island because most of the gold were gone. Between 2-3 years, you know, all the gold was gone with the Spaniard already. So they had less interest and not that a strong army and men also to counter the French and the French interest also for the island of Hispaniola. So, but the island of Tortuga was also an interesting spot because of its place in the Caribbean island, because it was just in front of the Canal du Vent, and that's where everybody has to cross, you know. And the French says, okay, I'm settling there, you know. The Dutch, the Vikings start arriving also in this area. The Brits also start to put themselves, you know, in this area. You know, and a lot of things that you see really in the pirates in the Caribbean, you know, are part of the real history also of the Caribbean island. You know, so there were a lot of interest, and for people to see the galleon, you know, going down with all the gold, and people had to pay for you to cross with your things in this area. So this period is an important period because that's what will determine, you know, the fate also of the island of Hispaniola. Because of what I explained, the interest of the French, the interest for the Spanish also to continue their exploration and continue their work in Mexico and Mexico cities and so on. And at the same time, is the political context also of the time. It's the time of the Great War also in Europe, you know, between the Dutch, the French, the Brits, and the Spanish. At that time, what we call the Great World War. And the guys, you know, said, you know, they had an interesting meeting in Haitian white, called it Wiswick. But the white spelling is what you have on the right. Is Wiswick, which is still a little town in the Dutch Republic in Holland. So they met there and said, you know, let's settle the matter. So we want the passage of the island of Tortuga for us to go down our things to Europe. You want a piece of the island of Hispaniola? Let's make a deal, you know. And they made the deal. And they split the island in two, you know. We end up with the one-third of this part because the land on this part, which is now Haiti, was the most fertile, you know, for agriculture. And the French empire at that time had a lot of interest in finding spices and sugar and cinnamon and cotton and those kind of stuff. So for them, it was, and they were also familiar with this part of the island because they've been in the Tortuga Island for many, many, many years. And they have traveled, you know, downward to the Artibonite Valley and have the relationship there. So for them, it was really natural that they really wanted to have this site of the island, which is now Haiti. It's not an accident. After the Treaty of Wiswick, the French, you know, took over and formed their position in the island of Tortuga from 1659. They set up, you know, their colony and they called the capital city Saint-Domingue. And they settled there in the country. But once the Treaty of Wiswick is settled, the French took part of the one third of the island, so they converted the island really. And that's where the slavery really becoming at its peak, you know. And all these things, you have all the international context at that time. You have the international context in Africa at that time, where tribes, you know, were fighting among tribes. Those who win get the space. So if you lose, you become slave. And you had at that time, in the different era, we mentioned that the globalization period that started in the Cameroon River down there into and goes all to the Cameroon River going up to Morocco. And people were from Cameroon to Morocco, you know, buying and trading and so on. So people who lost the war during that time in Africa, you know, they were given basically given to the Arab traders, you know. So, and that's where the Arab traders, you know, were just trading slaves. And the Senegal market and one of the island of Goa becomes really a huge market where different traders and slave traders came to buy slaves, you know, in Africa. And those slaves, and a great movie which is very accurate is Amistad, you know, that probably you should, that I would recommend really for you to watch if you haven't seen it. That really gives a great account of the plight, the history, and how people from Africa, you know, were transported into this side of the continent. But in the middle of the 16th centuries, you have Saint-Domingue become really producing 40% of the sugar for France and Britain, and accounted for 40% of the foreign trade, you know? So that means 40% of the GDP from these countries, you know, were based on the product of the slavery in Hispaniola, in Saint-Domingue at that time. And the second French expedition, when Leclerc, you know, arrived in the country to protect the country, you know, Leclerc says, you know, oh my Lord, this is a pearl that falls from God's bird, you know, beard, you know. So the flourishness of the colony and what was producing in there, it was one of the what I would say greatest, you know, economic production in history. But also it was a human misery also, and how people were treated and where and was living on the plantation, and all this was based on what I call the Code Noir, you know, the Code Noir of the 1685, because at the highest point of the trade slave, and people start rebelling, and you have a couple of Maroon that was living in the plantation, that was mostly in this area of Port-au-Prince, and going down into here and Léogâne and so on. And until today, you have a couple of sugarcane plantations still in Léogâne, you on here. And all these things in Port-au-Prince were really the heart of the sugarcane plantation and the colonial production of the empire. So to protect the plantation, Louis XIV took a decree that was valid for all the colony, not only for Haiti, Saint-Domingue, but it was also valid for Saint Louis in Senegal. It was also valid for Guinea and all the colony that they had, you know, that regulate really the slavery in Saint-Domingue and the rest of the French colonial empire. So you had a population of slaves in Saint-Domingue only that varied between 500,000 to 700,000 slaves that were working on the plantation. And the essence of the Code Noir is that all individuals of black descent that come to the island, you know, are possession, you know. The kids, if they had kids, they become possession of the master. If they have something, they become possession of the master. If they created something, anything, artistic, cultural, whatever it becomes the possession of the master. They don't have any right to complain, and the master can dispose even their life as they see fit. You know, so that's you can find and with the Code Noir, it's an interesting piece of also. But the situation of Haiti, I mean, you had all this period from the Côte d'Ivoire, and you have, even though the French population, really, and the French colony, and we mentioned that yesterday, the difference between the French colonization with the British or the Spanish colonization, you had normally the population of Haiti normally should have been of the clearer skin, I would say, if we had a commingling like you had during the Spanish, you know, colonization. But it was not done. But nevertheless, you had also some Spanish masters, you know, that had, you know, a couple of kids during the Spanish the French colonization, and these people, they were either called the bastard or the mulattoes, you know. They were mulattoes if they were recognized by the fathers, you know. So, and all these people, they also became slaves, you know. They didn't have a different right, really, than the slave. And their right would be recognized in the middle of the 17th centuries, where the Spanish, the slaves start to organize themselves. And the French colonizers, you know, they needed more men. And the only way they could have more men was to recognize the right of the mulattoes, you know. And this right was not a given, something, it's a blanket right that you have it and you have it for life. It's conditioned to your allegiance to the masters and so on. So, but this mulatto situation become and still an issue which is unsettled until today. And we are all, you know, all Haitian and all of us, you know, that have been away or live outside of the country or live in country with ethnic conflict and ethnic situation, we are always amazed that we never had really an ethnic cleansing or something like that, you know, that happened in this country, you know. But this is a situation that is really unsettled because the mulattoes goes back and forth. They participated with the slave, with the liberation movement, because their own interest was at stake. Because under the independence battle, all the right of the mulattoes was revoked, you know, by the French expeditors that Napoleon sent to the island. So because they lose their right, so they join the slave in the fight to protect their own right, you know. But after the independence, you know, the mulattoes move back to their camp and the black move back to their own camp, you know. And this situation is never resolved. So it's the, what we call the dialectic in the Haitian history. It's the contradiction around them, but also the facts also that surround those events in the country. In the middle of the 17th century, that's where, as I explained, the slave situation, slavery was at its peak. That's where the colonies start producing, you know, full-fledged. You have not only sugar cane, but you have all the production and the byproduct of sugars, you know, sugar, rum, cigars, all that come with it, you know, on the day. And they needed more slaves, you know, to work on the plantation. And that's where the slaves start to rebel, you know, and start to organize themselves. But also the context of the 1791 also in France. That's where you have the nationalists also that took power and start questioning the power of the king in France, and that provided a context for the slave, you know, to rise, and with the attention of the French Empire turning to their own problem that they have in France, gave really a good space for the slave, for them to continue organizing themselves and for them to rise, you know. And this movement and insurrection was headed by Toussaint Louverture, who happened to be what I call a half-free man, because he was working on the plantation. He was not working on the plantation. He spent his entire life in the house and taking care of horses, and he was what we call in French a régisseur, somebody that was taking care of the house, a kind of major dog, you know, that was his role. So he knew, he received the white people, he lives around them, he knew how they live, and so on, and he was part of their life.
I think
so,
he was the butler.
Yeah. So that gave him really real insight into the life of the French master. So
did that 13-year period end with a big battle or something, or was it just guerrilla warfare that went on and on?
It started with a real war, really. The city of from the patient, and that's what you have to understand also from the south and the north of the Haiti. From here to here, that's what we have, probably have a slide about that too. That's what we call the yeoman, you know? Writers, debonair people, dreamers, you know, those kind of people. And from Port-au-Prince up, so you have the proud people that are really fighting and taking care of slavery and so on. So the slaves start the revolt really in the northern part of Haiti and spread out to the plantations. And the war started really by burning the plantation. So it was real guerrilla warfare, burning and hiding and taking the mountain and so on. And that's what you would see later, that France says that they need to be repaid for the destruction that happened to the colony, you know, because it, all these things, you know, were burned down. So from 1804 to 1815, you know, so that's, you had a great battle of for the independence, and but that happened really in the sorrow and a lot of death and destruction. And everybody, I mean, always mentioned why Haitian was not able to secure the same political settlement that the Martinican and the Guadeloupean, you know, did with the French. For a simple reason, that the people that were left in the country at the time of the revolution and that were heading the revolution, the only one that could have made a difference was Toussaint Louverture, because he was the one who was, as a butler, who knew French, who spoke French, who knew about negotiation from his relationship with the French master, could have done something, but was not accepted as a real negotiator for the Haitian slave, and finally died in Fort de Joux. And besides Toussaint, you didn't really have somebody that rise up, who had an education, who could present themselves as a negotiator, you know, for the Haitian cause, you know. And all this really was done really in desperation, because there was no way out, and the people believed there was no way out for them. The only way for them to be able to do something was, you know, bird plantation, you know, we win it or we lose it.
Can I say something about Toussaint? Because Toussaint was a butler and he knows the mentality of the French, so but he was strict. They told him that they want to have a conversation with him, and they knew that he was going to be a good leader for the revolution after the revolution in 1804 when we have our independence. So they tricked him. They said, I want to talk with you. And then they took him to a prison that called Fort de Joux in France, and then where they let him die, right like that. Mm-hmm. So the people in Haiti were desperate for a leader, and they didn't have that leader they were expecting to have, that they were waiting for. Mm-hmm. It's one of the problems that started with leader that we didn't have after the revolution.
And that's what happened, because when Toussaint being gone and died in France, so nobody, I mean, in the revolution, even Dessalines, said, you know, we will not trust the French anymore, you know. And in bracket, this also paved the way for the negotiation for the Guadeloupean and the Martinican, because the French also learned from that experience, you know, and that gave people like Césaire and the others, you know, the opportunity for them to negotiate their own settlement with the French colonizers. So, in 1804, after all this battle and burning and suffering and all these things, so Dessalines ended 200 years of slavery and declared Haiti an independent nation and become the governor general of the Free Nation. So it was a huge opportunity for the island, you know, becoming free and taking their destiny into their hands.
And who was Dessalines?
Dessalines was one of the generals that took off after Toussaint. When Toussaint died in Fort de Joux in France, he rise up as the new leader for the independence battle. But he was poorly educated, you know, not educated at all, you know. But he was named the general of the slavery movement because of his courage, you know, and so on. But he had no education at all. Cyril James put it really that way in the Black Jacobins, and he says, you know, the transformation of slaves, trembling in hundreds before a single white man into a people able to organize themselves and defeat the most powerful European nation of their day, is one of the great epic of revolutionary struggle and achievement. But this epic, really, and is something that Haitian, you know, is still carrying, because this should have never happened, really. In human history. But it's not only the French putting, not recognizing the new nation, but also we have to recognize Haitians themselves also, you know, have squandered their own assets and their own opportunities, you know. The first thing that happened after the independence is what I explained. The mulattoes return to the staff and create their own political organizations, you know? And the black slave go back to the north, you know? And the Dessalines in the middle trying to, you know, mediate between the two groups. The first thing that he tried to do is the land reform, which is one of the major issues today after the earthquake. To say, you know, land that we can distribute to people, to the slave and the poor slave, for them to cultivate and have a way out and so on. He tried an economic reform, a market integration, you know, and said, now we are a new nation and we have the art and skill. We were a flourishing colony under the French masters. Why can't we still keep that on, you know, and trade with the Caribbean island and so on, you know? But nobody was interested to come back to the plantation again, you know. There is a despair attempt at socialization, and the meeting of mind that took place between Geoffroy, Dessalines, and Christophe, trying to mediate between the mulattoes and the black for them to come back around the table to create really an integrated nation, you know. And finally, the result of all that mediation and trying to bring the nation together end up with the assassination of Dessalines, you know, 2 years after the independence. So it was a great missed opportunity in the history of the country, but nobody did that. Haitians themselves, you know, hard to blame, to be blamed by this situation. And on top of that, the French says, you know, for us to recognize the new nation, you know, we will put a blockus on the country, an embargo, that was the first embargo, and they asked that they will be repaid, you know, 150 million francs for the damage that incurred during the revolution, you know. And that the reason why, for example, a singer like Mano Charmaine, Mano would say, for example, a singer like Mano, Mano would tell you that that we don't need to believe in the world leaders and the international organization because. La médecine internationale, ça met pas son côté. This is a great critique of Mano from this era. So, I mean, Mano's point here is the international organization, really, and until today, will not be the one that save us from our economic situation, you know? There are people that, you know, sorry, Philip, there are people that sit around a table, you know, they have the best wine that you can find, you know? They make a lot of analysis because they don't really know what is going on in this country, and they should have done something about this, you know. And we shouldn't really wait on them for them to do something for Haiti. And it is in the Haitian belief that really the repayment and the agreement of Jean-Pierre Boyer in 1825 to repay France, you know, plunge Haiti in an economic, you know, downfall. So you have a great period from 1825 from Jean-Pierre Boyer to really 1915 of pendulum cycle, you know. You may have four governments in 2 months, you know, because of the fight between the mulatto on somewhere and the black on the others, and not being able really to form and bring the nation back. Jean-Pierre Boyer will have an attempt at doing that, and that's the reason why he tried really to mediate and settle with France, you know. Yeah, he believed that was his option. And the second thing that he did was trying to not only reunify the South and the North, that will unify the entire island of Hispaniola, you know? And that's one of the situations we still have today with Dominicans, you know, because they believe that they lost 25 years of their history because of this attempt at reunifying the island. So you had really, and since Cincinnatus Lecon, you know, took power, and they are trying to organize the nation in 1914, coming back with, and getting out of this pendulum cycle and so on. And there was an assassination also in Port-au-Prince. And people believe that the government of Lecomte was responsible for the assassination. And there was a riot. They burned the National Palace. And the president, you know, took refuge to the French ambassador's house. And the populace, you know, went to the ambassadors, get the president out, you know, and kill him. And during that period, you know, I mean, you can remember 1914, 1915, that was the First World, the context of the First World War I, and also the Great Passage also that you have in the Caribbean, with the interest of the German also in on the Caribbean island and so on. So Wilson says, if they don't do something, somebody else will do something. It better be us. So, and that was the first invasion of the United States in the island. So, so that's what you have. After the occupation, you have also a long period of stabilization that, that come in. And the reign of Duvalier and the reign of Papadoc that you know, killing and torturing people and the repressive regime.
Louis, I don't think people know that.
They don't?
Yes. I mean, it's time for lunch, but I don't think people know that.
Okay, so I'm a little bit cautious about the time, but yeah. If we can just, we can spend the time here. Really, Duvalier come into power after a tumultuous period. The American left, created the army that we had at that time, created a political system for the country, and you have a couple of governments that came in. You have, in 1940, in 45, 46, the new nationalist movement after the American occupation, and what we call the indigenous movement. It's a group of writers, black writers, and that start working and taking the influence of the Martinican, Aimé Césaire in Guadeloupe and Martinique and so on, and the movement of black powers and those kind of stuff around the world. And they created a great indigenous movement. And Duvalier was one of the writers, medical doctor, but writer in this indigenous movement. He became minister of the government of Estimé, Dumas Estimé, and start to rise in the intellectual circle, but also in the power circle. So naturally, in that Estimé was overthrown by a military coup in 1950, 51, 52, and the new military regime organized election. And one guy that rise up to the crowd was Duvalier. He was a well-known writer, and he had participated in the containing Pien. What would be Pien? Pien.
Pien is a thing that you have in your feet that kind of eat your body. I don't know the name in English.
Yeah, we have Pien. We even have Pien in the Bible.
Oh, like parasite?
No, lepers?
Lepers, yeah.
Voila.
So, and Duvalier created really, was one of the medical doctors that went to the countryside and treated people for free. You know, he was well known.
Leprosy.
And he was really duly elected in 1957 with a large majority of vote and so on, and rise to power. In 1964, normally, his term was of 7 years. In 64, he was supposed to leave power. And in 64, June 64, he declared himself, you know, president for life. And that's where a couple of people start to protest. And you would have the first wave of repression. And that's where many Haitians start to go and leave the country. And many of them end up in Africa as teachers in Senegal, in Cameroon, and many other places. You know, and from 1964, and at that time, the context, again, the political context also, that was not in favor of Haiti. And that's where the Cuban, Fidel Castro, and the other guys took the Manuel Maestra, you know, start the guerrilla warfare in the region. And the Americans said, naturally, we don't want another Cuba in our hand, you know. So if we don't want another Cuba in our hand, we need to support Duvalier and not leaving all these intellectuals and fanatics and Marxists and so on to take power in this thing, and we lose our hegemonic powers in the region, you know. And they supported Duvalier. And so on. And this is the way that the regime also was able to perpetuate themselves and stay on power because of this unfavorable political context of the time, you know, with Cuba on the other side. So, yeah. And this regime lasted 35 years until 1986 and fell down. Duvalier went to exile. And you had also from 1986 to 1991, a long, long, long pendulum also, until Aristide went to power. Great hope, opportunities, but this lasted 9 months. Ousted by the militaries, and the hope was shattered. Yeah. Aristide returned with the help of the 20,000 troops of the U.S., to restore him in power, but didn't, you know, do what he was supposed to be doing. He promises a lot of things to the American administration and couldn't deliver, and he has to be taken back. So, again, from Haiti. Yeah, go ahead. And you have Préval that came in after Aristide, and Préval was one of Aristide's friends, you know, that took power with him. But he was the one, really, who was able to really have two consecutive terms in power without any problem, you know. But with the unfortunate event of the earthquake, and he was not able to respond, he was nowhere to be found, affected himself, you know, half of his government, you know, was lost and so on. And you have now an amount of NGO managing the country. So, in the middle of this turmoil of the earthquake, trying to do the rebuilding and all these things, so you have a situation that Michel Martelly, who is not a politician, who is not somebody that we would say who is well-educated, you know, from the Haitian standard, was a popular musician that get into the race just to annoy a couple of politicians, and even said that himself in private, he went get in the race, you know, as a matter of a joke. He was just playing domino on a Sunday evening with a couple of friends, and says, "You know, guys, I'm going to put myself on the list." And somebody said, "You know, I challenge you 500 good if you do that." Seriously, I mean. And he said, "You don't know me, I'm going to do it." He gathered his paper and put himself on the list. But everybody said, "Oh, Mickey on the list," you know. I mean, but people like him, like his music. He used his music, you know. All his political demonstration, you know. He did that with music. He gathered a bunch of musicians. And when Wyclef didn't make it, he said, "Wyclef, let's team up." And Wyclef teamed up with him. Ram and all the musicians took the street, and he was elected, you know. So, but Now he has a huge problem on his hand.
When Dubai came back, when he come back, and Harris Reed even,
both of them,
we all came back with this reaction within him.
Of curiosity, because you know it's a problem of the memory also of the young people. Those people who have probably 25, 30 years really don't know anything about Dubai. You know, it's the fate of the cultural issues. You know, so he has a huge problem for him to settle. You know, the unemployment and fighting the economic issues, the land issues and the land reform. You know, but beyond the materialism. Problem, I think it's a really real problem for all of us, really, that are interested by Haiti, you know? It's a tragedy, I would say. I mean, and as I started, you know, this thing, saying that we are still crying and weeping. But it's also an opportunity for us who are interested in Haiti to get it right this time, you know? Nation building has never been on the agenda for Haiti, you know. Even since the independence, you saw that. Decentralization has never been also on the agenda because everything is concentrated in the Republic of Port-au-Prince. And that the reason why we need to get this right as well. When people said Haiti has been destroyed, you know, let's say that Port-au-Prince has been destroyed, and we lost a lot of people in Port-au-Prince, and we are still weeping, you know, for these people. But Haiti is still there, you know. So that means there's something that needs and that must be done for us to decentralize the country and create a pole of economic growth in this country. Why people are concentrated in Port-au-Prince? That's why you can have an education, you can have healthcare, that's why you can have access to any public service. You know, if you need a passport, you have to come to Port-au-Prince. You need a plate, license plate, you have to come to Port-au-Prince. Why is that so? You know, so that means there's something that we didn't get right. The focus on education and capacity building also is the next challenge because, you know, most of the people that died, unfortunately, they were either students or university or professors, you know, in school, elementary school or universities and any places, because they were the ones that were still in class, you know. So the challenge for us remain, you know, a huge challenge, you know, to bring back capacities in the country. Job creation and so on. I was asked by the new administration to write a brief for them on the creation of the Ministry of Employment. So I just did that and sent that to them. But that's one of the of the challenges that we have, you know. Why people are going to Miami and Florida? I mean, it's because of the opportunity, you know, that they have and so on. So you have those kind of stuff, you know, that need to be done. Haiti can be back on its feet really very quickly. I mean, you see, I show you a couple of pictures of the beaches and the places of Haiti that remain untouched. You know, the issue of environmental protection and disaster risk reduction. I'm still mad, really. Mad at myself. Mad at, you know, the political system. Mad at the lack of norm and so on that we have in the country. You know, I never shared that with anybody, but I said, you know, when I talked to Renee, in December, January, and said, you know, are you able to come? I don't know, but I still mad at myself, you know, saying, you know, I should have been there, you know. But instead, I had obligation, and I went to South Africa, and so on. I don't know what could have, I could have done, but I'm still mad at that, you know, because of the norms and all these things, you know, that doesn't exist in the country, you know. Many people die because of that. You have the earthquake. That's true, but many countries and many places have earthquake, you know? But there's no norm for building, no norm for construction, you know? And there's no regulation, and nobody's enforcing those kind of stuff, you know?
Did you think of running for president?
You should have had someone challenge him while he was playing dominoes.
This is not where I think I can. But you know, there's other things, you know, that we can show in the country. So it was a challenge working you through all this, you know. I mean,
thank you.
In a couple of minutes.